as you know, we've been talking about it all along, another week of fervent political activity here, the UK and Brussels, but it is a alleged case of much heat but no light. Well, one institution helping Ireland prepare for breakfast, good, bad or indifferent, is the European Investment Bank, and its vice president is Andrew MacDool, and he's just joined us in studio. He was also, in another incarnation, advisor to the former Taoiseach, Enda Kenny. You're very welcome indeed to the programme, Andrew.
Can I
just ask you a question, first of all, that has nothing to do with this. You came home yesterday because you wanted to bring your son to the rugby match.
Yes, yes, we flew in Friday evening. I brought my 10-year-old son, Leon, to the rugby yesterday. He was Ireland's biggest rugby fan, so he was... But you know what's interesting? It's the first time he's ever seen Ireland lose. I brought him to a lot of Ireland rugby matches.
Right.
I think by the time I was 10... I'd never seen Ireland win. So it was a good life lesson for him.
Okay. I just thought, you know, that excitement of coming home for a big event, guaranteed to win, not so good.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get back to what's in it. Remind us again of who, what, where, why and when is the EIB?
Well, the EIB is a European Investment Bank. It's the EU bank, so public bank owned by the member states, still 28 member states of the European Union, and set up under the Treaty of Rome. So we celebrated our 60th anniversary last year. And the purpose of the bank is not to make a profit, unlike commercial banks, but rather to finance projects that deliver on the policy objectives of the European Union and the member states. So a lot of our projects are in relation to infrastructure, climate action, protecting the environment, supporting SMEs and jobs, supporting
innovation. And are you lending the money to governments?
Both. We lend to both governments and indeed to private sector promoters of projects. So.
And what are your rates of interest?
Well, it all depends on the project. And so we do have to earn a return. We do have to get our money back. So it's not a charity and we don't provide grant aid. But we do provide much lower interest rates than private sector financiers.
Say like?
Well, than any of the private sector banks, because, I mean, we fund 1%, on the markets.
1%, 2%?
Well, when we're lending to governments, who are obviously the most creditworthy risks we can take, less
we
than
hope.
1%. Well, we certainly hope, but that's our analysis. When we lend to the member states themselves, we're lending to creditworthy governments and there's no possibility of default. So we're able to basically lend to them at what we fund on the markets, which is often less than 1%. If we're lending to very high-risk corporate innovation projects with no collateral and no security, obviously the interest rates are going to be higher and the terms are going to be shorter. So it all depends on the project. But the key point is we're not trying to make a profit. What we're trying to do is support projects that deliver on important policy objectives, and that distinguishes us from the private
Italy?
Sector.
Pardon?
What about Italy? What's your interest rate for Italy, for an example?
Well, I mean, it depends on the term, obviously, of the loan. But obviously, you know, the 10-year bond in Italy is about 3% at the moment. We will lend for slightly less than that for public sector Italian projects. We've got a 60 billion Italian portfolio, so we're watching, obviously, the economic developments in Italy very, very, very closely. But obviously, we continue to support the Italian economy because what we lend for is always investment. So we're not lending to governments to finance just their budget shortfalls or their deficits, if they're, you know, right. What we're lending for is investment projects that support economic growth.
Is it one of the assessments you have to make? Is it that, say, if you look at a country like Italy, that it's too big to fail? Like we weren't, in a sense, and Greece wasn't. I mean, we took a terrible hiding, and so did Greece, but. I mean, Italy's a very big country.
It's a very big country, but with a very large level of debt, and that's clearly recognised. But it's a founding member of obviously the European Union and of Economic and Monetary Union, and the way we price our loans and the way we analyse the situation is that is not going to change, and therefore, when we lend to Italy, it's a safe bet. And so we'll continue to support good Italian projects. I mean, the challenge facing the Italian economy is that there's been effectively no productivity growth in the Italian economy for 18 years. So in fact, rather than cutting back in those type of investments, we need to finance more of those type of investments that actually lead to growth in living standards in Italy.
Let's come back to this parish now, because but I just think of that lurking in the background, and we're so consumed with Brexit, we're kind of not watching the rest of Europe in the way we might have at another stage. So what have you done to date, and what is your plan from here on in terms of Brexit, essentially?
Well, I mean, at the request of the Irish government, we've been asked to put in place supports, if you like, soft loan supports for farmers and SMEs that may be affected by Brexit.
A soft loan?
Well, a soft loan is basically a loan on terms and conditions not available from the commercial banks here.
Right.
And we have approved at the EIB as the EU bank, and this is an EU institution, so we've also been asked to do this by the European Commission and the Irish government as evidence of European solidarity for Ireland and recognition that by far and away Ireland is the most exposed economy to the downside risks of Brexit. We were asked to put in place a package of measures to work with the Strategic Banking Corporation of Ireland, which is the Irish National Promotional Institution, to put in place measures that make sure access to finance is not going to be an issue for Irish farmers and SMEs. So, for example, you can imagine how farmers already have been impacted by the change in the exchange rate since 2016. So the exchange rate went from about 80 sterling to the euro to 88, 89, whatever it is in the last few weeks. That had an impact, particularly at the end of 2016 and 2017. So we put in place a working capital scheme that allowed farmers to borrow without collateral for up to 3 years at less than 3%, you know, which was a rate not available from the commercial banks for working capital.
Yeah, but can I ask you, just to understand it, you put loans in, make them available for somebody that's in difficulty because of exchange rates. Like, how did they pay them back? It's not for productivity, is it? It's kind of to hold your hand?
Well, initially, it was working capital, to see farmers through a difficult set of price changes for their goods. We do it through the commercial banks. So when you borrow, you know, when these EIB loans come through, it's through the commercial banks and the Strategic Banking Corporation of Ireland. So we're not engaging directly with individual farmers. What we're doing is basically providing a guarantee through the Strategic Banking Corporation to the commercial banks that when they lend to farmers or indeed other SMEs that may be affected by Brexit, we'll take a large guarantee against some of the losses. It makes it much more attractive for the banks to do those loans because they're protected against a large part of the losses, and that way they can get the interest rates down and the collateral requirements down.
Right.
So initially it's working capital, so it's a short-term kind of support. But what we want to do now is to support the announcement made by the government in the October budget for what's called a future loan growth scheme. And that is a much longer term lending operation for 8 to 10 years for SMEs and slightly larger businesses that are now looking at investments, say, in new products, new services, new markets that cut their exposure to the UK, that essentially provide them with a way out of their existing dependence on the UK markets. Mm-hmm. So that is the type of longer-term investment that'll increase their competitiveness, their productivity in new markets, new products.
Right.
Classic example would be an Irish, you know, dairy processor that makes cheddar, you know, for the UK market. How are they going to get into other markets?
How are they going to make
the
brie?
Continentals don't love cheddar. Yeah.
So say we don't like cheddar so much on the continent. May I say that? I know it's not the cheese we would eat there.
Yeah. So that's it. So we're looking
at cheddar manufacturers.
We're looking at Irish firms now looking to make mozzarella.
Yeah.
Oh,
for example.
Sure, isn't there one down in West Cork?
Yeah,
oh,
there
he
is
makes
already.
Lovely mozzarella.
So that's the general idea.
Right.
It's a buffalo mozzarella.
So even in this period of great uncertainty, firms want to now make investments in order to diversify their risks.
Yeah.
But they need financing that simply isn't available from the commercial banks.
Now, the other thing which I found very, very interesting is your involvement with Irish Ferries.
Yes, yes. So recently we've signed loan contracts with Irish Ferries for, I think it was a total of 135 million for two new vessels. The William Butler Yeats that just arrived just before Christmas and launched his first service there about 2 weeks ago. And a new vessel that's arriving next year that's going to be the largest ferry in the world. And Obviously, this is part of their business plan, their normal operations to increase capacity. But I suppose there is a Brexit dimension in that it certainly provides Ireland with increased direct ferry capacity into continental markets if needed.
Yes, it's envisaged initially just on the Holyhead run, but if needs be, it can head for France.
Yeah, I think it'll do the Holyhead run on the winter schedule, and then on the summer schedule they'll shift it to France. And,
yeah.
But certainly that increases Ireland's connectivity, if you like, to continental Europe. We've also financed the expansion of the Port of Cork for similar reasons. So they're obviously moving the port end to Ringaskiddy in Cork. And together with the Irish Strategic Investment Fund, we finance the expansion of that. And that's the creation of a deep water port in Cork that, again, will provide direct access to continental European ports, to Rotterdam in particular, but also to have for Ireland in the event that it's needed in order to bypass UK
preparing
markets.
For war, isn't
drive
it?
Around
sorry,
the Harry.
Yeah, just what's the total loan, the value of the loan book to Ireland at the moment? And is it at the maximum it could be? And I presume that it's much higher than it was than it was when you were in government, Andrew, and perhaps Ireland's credit rating wasn't quite so buoyant as it is now. And I noticed that you've also advanced or in the process of advancing a substantial loan as well to the National Children's Hospital to that project. There's no concerns about that in the offing, is there?
Well, business is definitely picking up in Ireland, and I think obviously we're putting a special effort into Ireland for the reasons I've mentioned, the recognition that Ireland is particularly exposed to Brexit. We established an office here for the first time in Dublin 2 years ago, headed by Cormac Murphy, and that's definitely helped in terms of, you know, originating new deals in Ireland. So there's no limit on what we can do in Ireland. So we signed about $1 billion last year of deals in Ireland. That's definitely up quite significantly.
Did you fund the Children's Hospital?
We've loaned $490 million to the government for the Children's Hospital.
That was the total cost originally.
No, we never financed the entire cost of the hospital.
Joking.
So.
Well, it was at the very outset.
Yeah.
But he's saying it must have been higher already at that point because they would not finance that.
Yeah, when you lent them the 490,
that was
percentage,
only last year.
What's that?
So it was 983 million.
We only ever financed up to 50% of a project. So
let's get this straight. When you lent the 490 million, you were told that was 50% of the cost of the hospital.
Including some of the IT costs.
Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, but that shows that it was already known. Yeah.
Including some of the IT. So when you add, the IT was always on top of the original construction cost. So when you add that in, it was the total eligible investment costs for us were approaching $1 billion by the time
we signed
the
loan. What was the date of that loan?
We signed the loan in December 2018, excuse me, just over a year ago, 14 months ago.
2017.
Yeah.
So that means that $1 billion cost was known at Christmas 2017.
That's the point I was making.
Well, when you include the IT costs,
I think the figure in November 2017 was 983 million.
Yeah,
so it would have been roughly about half of that when you add in the IT costs.
So if the cost of the hospital goes up, can you lend them more money? Because you're saying your maximum is 50%. So for an example, if we told you it was 4 billion for the hospital, would you lend us 2 billion?
I mean, there's no application to us for additional
it's
financing for the National Children's Hospital. I think
hypothetically,
we'll consider any application. I mean, I don't see it as being a realistic prospect that the Irish government is going to ask us for an additional finance for this particular project.
You don't.
No, I don't think so, because it's already, you know, it's already been financed through additional contributions from the Exchequer. So I don't think that is part of the funding plan. I should say.
And drawn down that money?
They have drawn down some of it, yes, and over the course of 2018. But I should say, we finance hundreds of infrastructure projects.
Yeah.
You know, every year across Europe, it's not unusual, obviously, that we would see cost overruns and indeed, you know, delays in major infrastructure projects. And hospitals, in particular, I should say, are complex projects to deliver. We always.
I was listening to somebody who did it, who said it's not rocket science.
I can tell you from our experience, and we must have financed dozens of hospitals across Europe. Some of them have come in on time and on budget, but many have not, and they are always highly political projects in terms of delivery and the final specifications. So, you know, we'll continue to monitor, obviously, the project as we do with every infrastructure project, but we've no particular concerns. Our loan is to the Irish government, so we've no particular, obviously, credit concerns on this loan.
Arsila, did you want to come in on those loans to cushion the way?
Yeah, I think they will be extremely important, because I think the exposure of Ireland to Britain, you know, the way we are the only country in the EU with double digits exports to Great Britain and double digits imports from Britain. I just saw a list yesterday, so there's we are extremely exposed, and I think it will...
Are your clients concerned, is what I'm really saying?
My clients?
Mm.
My clients are concerned to a certain extent, but you see, my practice is very international. So a lot of my clients are already German, Austrian, they might be Swiss, French, Polish, US clients. Okay, so they are a very international crowd. But yes, of course, some, let's say, have already started projects because of Brexit. I have a client who has moved its warehouse from the north and is now building one in North County Dublin, or has nearly finished building one for a large multinational drugs company, so that they can stay within the EU after Brexit. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of extra, I would think, a lot of extra work. But yes, smaller companies, they're very worried. Of course, if they are for the moment exporting most of their ware, what they produce, into the UK market, it's a big headache for them, a massive headache. And the biggest headache for the moment is companies like to plan. So they like to know today, let's say they have a 24 months cycle.
Yeah.
And for the moment, nobody can plan for the next 24 months, because as we heard today, Theresa May is still in battle. The other thinks the war is over. So you see, there's absolutely no certainty what's going to happen. And companies, it's serious for companies. It's a serious headache. If they now have to order how much they need of something for in 24 months, they haven't a clue.
Right.
They don't know. They cannot plan. And that's a big criticism of all companies. And that's small, medium and large size companies.
Okay.
This complete uncertainty and ongoing uncertainty for long and long and long. It's a big problem and it's costly. It's costly for them.
OK. The other uncertainty, which is kind of not directly related to what you're doing, but presumably will impact. You referred to Dan O'Brien's article in the, I think it's in the Sindo, today. And he was referring to the OECD thing that was published yesterday, I do believe. We've had our battles with Europe about our tax rates, and every minister for finance has held the line. But the, you know, you can feel a tsunami building up. But now the OECD.
Yeah, Dan O'Brien's point is really that the Americans seem to be changing their tune about how they're going to go about taxing multinationals. As we can see, there's a huge blowback against multinationals, you know, in any way, particularly Facebook. So what the OECD is looking at is a sales tax, meaning where the products are sold, that needs to be taxed. So, you know, that would absolutely decimate the way we do our tax situation here. And there seems to be...
Explain how that would decimate us.
Well, for an example, you know, Google that I alluded to earlier, you know, Google washes all its money from Europe and says it's sold out of Ireland, you know, well, Bermuda, really, but it's a company incorporated in Ireland. So they would then have to go to each country and say, look, well, we're selling X amount of sales here in the UK, in France, and we'd pay the tax there.
Isn't that what the Europe wants them to do?
That was the basis of the Apple judgment, was it not?
It was the basis of what Europe wanted to do also, but there was such backlash. I mean, we were totally against it. Ireland was totally against it, but there's other countries against it also, so it's been slowed up. But what Dan O'Brien's article is saying now, the Americans seem to be getting on board with this now, so if they get on board with it, then this thing is actually going to happen. So he was saying, well, you shouldn't be fearful of the EU because they're so slow at doing these things. We were able to block it, but you won't be able to block this if it's coming towards from America. I mean, again, I've been on this show before arguing about the Apple tax. You know, I think that judgment was so clear and unequivocal that that money is ours. It's laughable that every single political party came out in this country and said, no, we don't want the money, it's not ours. You know, this ludicrous thing, the Minister of Finance at the time said, do you look at your Apple phone and see if it says made in Ireland? You know, how ridiculously stupid is that comment? That money...
Well, I can't remember which minister you're talking about, but you're not called them stupid.
Well, sorry, misleading, should I say, then. Misleading was... Well, it was basically saying because the phone hasn't gone made in Ireland on the bank. That money was washed through a stateless company that was incorporated in Ireland with no employees, and the EU then judged that the 13 billion should go to Ireland. It was very, very clear. But my point is, why every politician argued that it's no way it's our money is quite interesting.
What's your view on that, Bertie Ahern?
Well, you know, the original, the taxing has been going on for 30 years and the argument was going on. I was involved in moving it the 10% rate up to 12.5% and doing away with the higher corporation tax so that we could maintain the 12.5%. But I don't think anyone would argue. I mean, the huge announcements we've even got since the start of this year, and we're only in the beginning of February, have been massive. And it's not only because of the tax, but it's been hugely important. And I think the argument and the fear always is that if we give in anywhere, we could be rolled over on this issue. And, I mean, I remember, you know, when it's 25, 26 years ago when I was Minister of Finance, the French were always on my back. Every single ECOFIN Council meeting, they found some way. There was a socialist, I can't remember his name offhand, but it was a socialist leader, and they were forever on about Ireland, Ireland, Ireland. And why were they doing it? Because they were watching even at that stage that we were building up the pharmaceutical, the chemicals, the medical supplies industry. And while there is a real risk, I don't disagree with you, there's a real risk that too few of the companies that make up the Irish economy are given all the corporation tax. But at the same time, a huge amount of our quality employment and our really good investments is because we have the tax.
But can I just clarify one thing? Yes. I'm totally in favour of everything you said there, the 12.5% tax rate. Our problem is, for an example, the double Irish Dutch sandwich. Yes, yeah. Now, that was announced to the Irish people that we got rid of it in 2014. The numbers that I've just shown you in Google show they're still using it. So they're still using...
Wasn't that to end in 2020?
It's supposedly to end in 2020. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, so these corporations are not paying 12.5%. I think most Irish people would say we need to stick to the 12.5% rule and it's working very well.
I just finished one point, Mary. I think where we're vulnerable, and we're always vulnerable, if the multinationals wash things through the Irish economy, if we're on safe ground, I think, when... our figures show what's made in Ireland, what's made on the island of Ireland. I think what happens is if the stuff is made in Russia or China and it's been washed through our figures, that's where the weakness is. I think that's where we have to be very, very careful, that our multinational companies, that the production is in Ireland, because otherwise people are going to say that this is a tax haven, and that's the difference.
Can I make one point, just maybe, that we've all now talked about goods manufacturing, and this is actually not what this article is about.
Services.
Okay?
Yeah,
it's about digital services. So there's a massive difference there. And yes, the corporation tax rate, 12.5%, and this whole corporation tax, that's also a problematic area in some ways. And as you know, there last March, 2018, the EU came out with new proposals because they want to change the corporation tax, how that's done, but all over Europe. And for example, for the digital services, they want to create something what's called a digital PE, a digital permanent establishment, which we don't have in the rules yet. So that's where that's coming from. But the OECD, what they now want to do, it's all about digital services. Okay,
right.
So it's nothing to do with made somewhere. It's more about, let's say, somebody in Germany or France or Spain taking a website, looking at a website and then clicking on it and taking a service from there, you know, downloading a song or downloading some sort of service. And that's there. A big discussion is ongoing now. Where are those things going to be taxed? Are they taxed where they're provided from? From maybe, let's say, a corporation based in Ireland or in Luxembourg or the Netherlands? Or is it taxed where the person sits who has just clicked and consumed the piece of music or something and taken the piece? And there, obviously, economy. We are an economy here in Ireland with not a lot of consumers. So if it's getting taxed in the future, it's more where the consumers sit, obviously we will lose out more because we have less consumers.
I was just going to say a lot of these companies are incorporated in Ireland but not domiciled in Ireland. So they all have Irish names, for an example. Mm. Like Google's is... Google Ireland Holdings, you know, that's actually domiciled in Bermuda. So, you know, they are incorporated companies in Ireland, but they're not domiciled here.
But I see a big building down there and clatters of staff.
Well, we had this argument before because when I was arguing about the Apple tax, everybody screamed down at me saying, look, what about the Apple employees? You know, we need the jobs. The company that owes us the 13 billion and has paid over the 13 billion has no employees in Ireland, has no employees at all in the world. Mm. So you can't argue both ways about there's a lot of employee. Apple is saying that it's two different companies, so we should treat them as two different companies and they should pay us the rightful tax.
Yeah, it's kind of, that's kind of the moral leverage argument. I mean, and the difficulty is, and it happens in France as much as it happens in Ireland, is the headline rate for corporation tax bears no relation to the actual amount of tax that's paid. Mm-hmm. It's a big problem. I read a very interesting article by John Lanchester, the novelist and commentator in the Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, and he said there are three solutions to all of this. First one is to get rid of all the tax havens in the world, which isn't as difficult as people think. Number two, get rid of trusts. And number three, introduce a system of transparency. That's the most difficult part of the equation. Yeah, well, but if all three of those things were done, that difficulty would be avoided.
We've been talking about transparency now, you know, for a long time. You want to come in, Andrew?
Well, I mean, I think all these debates about corporate taxation is a reminder to Ireland of its traditional dependence on foreign direct investment as a driver of jobs, economic growth and innovation, and the need to continue to strengthen innovation, domestic innovation and enterprise, indigenous enterprise, as a source of future economic growth. The good thing for Ireland is actually, from an EIB perspective, we're seeing lots of middle-sized Irish companies now growing very quickly, innovation-led, research-led, filing a lot of patents, who are looking for growth capital from places like the European Investment Bank to become much larger companies. This isn't something we've seen a lot in Ireland in the past. And that's something we really have to foster. I always remember the Americans in the 1960s, late 50s and 60s, built the National Science Foundation because the Russians got to space first. So they said, we have to build a science infrastructure or else we'll all be speaking Russian in 20 years. That was the mentality. Ireland needs to build a national science and research infrastructure because of our vulnerability on tax. We need to change the basis of the competitive advantage of the country to something that's very sustainable in the long run. That needs to be financed, and that's, again, something the European Investment Bank is happy to support.
I would totally agree with that.
Yeah, well, if you take the role of the IDA and the role of Enterprise Ireland, there is such an organisation, isn't there, for science?
Oh, absolutely. Science Foundation Ireland.
Yeah.
It was, I think, one of the most one of the best things Ireland did in the 1990s was the decision to establish the Science Foundation Ireland. I think it's proved a huge success. But, like, as with everything, it competes for resources. But we need to remind ourselves that without that investment in research, in skills, in innovation, we're going to continue to be very heavily dependent on foreign direct investment.
But we do have that in a certain extent. We have the research and development tax credit. We have, you know, the way tax incentives for companies to do the research and development of new technologies in Ireland. So we have that for a long, long time. So I do think Ireland has all that to a certain extent, but I fully agree that it's brilliant that we are going to get more funding, because I think Ireland will need a lot of funding now, because we are so much more exposed to Brexit than any other country in Europe, that I think if that's not totally recognised, also just in monetary terms, it's not just about keeping a hard border off our island, but it's also to really give us sort of the help so that we can deliver on products, on new projects, so that we suffer hopefully as little as possible.
Harry?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with all that. I think FDI has given Ireland a bonanza or a boost over the years that probably isn't in proportion to the performance of our economy. And you have this kind of disparity that's emerged between GDP and the actual amount of product that's produced. And to some, it's been a problem. We seem to have coasted it, certainly since we've recovered in 2011. But I mean, I think what Andrew and Paul and Ursula were saying is completely true. We need to be able to innovate ourselves. And one of the things I'm just thinking about there is the Young Scientists of the Year Award. And we've got such amazing scientists that have emerged.
Positively
embarrassing. Over the last 30 or 40 years. And I sometimes wonder, do we have an adequate follow-on from that to see that we have this amazing thing at the end of second level, but are we continuing that into third level and beyond in terms of innovating and coming up with fresh and original ideas?
Emily, your take on all of this?
I suppose it's a view into a world I don't know much about. I would definitely think that European investment bank in investment in into medical research would be. I mean, does much of it go on at the moment?
Oh, it's one of the areas, obviously, that's supported heavily by Science Foundation Ireland. But actually, we're finding a very, very successful medtech cluster in Ireland, particularly in the west of Ireland, around Galway.
Yes. Oh, yeah, it's
and
huge.
We've got a very strong pipeline of companies coming to us looking for, you know, growth capital deals of, you know, 10 to 30 to 40
right.
million.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a really, there's kind of five hotspots around Europe for these type of technologies, for medical technologies, and Ireland is one of them.
Yeah, because I definitely think we'd have the medical expertise to keep researchers at home and build a really strong medical research economy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, before we wrap it up here, as I was saying, it sounds like preparations for war. If they're going to evacuate the Queen and we're going to go around England and all of that. But we're getting a connector, an interconnector with France.
Well, that's certainly one of the projects we're very interested in for a number of reasons. Airgrid are in relatively late stages in planning the first direct power connection between Ireland and continental Europe, which...
Because of Brexit, it is.
Well, I think it's for a number of reasons. I think it's probably taken on a new urgency, obviously, because of Brexit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think there's any overnight risk, you know, on the 1st of April to our power supplies in this country, but certainly as a longer-term measure... Clearly, this has taken on a new urgency, and the French are also interested. The idea would be to connect the south of Ireland with Brittany. The Commission are very interested in supporting the project with some European grant aid, and we'd be very interested in providing cheap, long-term debt to support the project. I mean, I think it's got to go through a few stages in terms of regulatory approval, government approval, and so on. But I think it's a fascinating project for a number of reasons. One is obviously security of supply for Ireland in the current context is clear. But also when you look at what's happening in Europe, I mean, the French have effectively decided to turn off nuclear in the next 15 years. The Germans have already made that decision and have now decided they're turning off coal by 2038.
Yes. Which
is providing 40% of German power at the moment. There's going to be a huge need for new power supplies, renewable power supplies into continental European markets. Ireland has a golden opportunity on the East Coast, along the Irish Sea, to export power into continental markets. And this is obviously how this could be done. So great project for a number of reasons and something I think that we should try and accelerate.
Right. Interesting, because when you hear people talking about Europe, I mean, a lot of Irish people go to France on their holidays and love France and all that. Mm-hmm. But at a political level, Macron is snapping at us about the tax. And you said they were on your back and all of that before. Will Britain be an enormous loss to us in those negotiations? You know.
They will, and I think there's no doubt about that. One of the great things of the last 40 years, I suppose, is the relation that was built up in the political system, but not only within the civil service, within state agencies, that the Irish and the British, by and large, were on the same page on most issues. When it came to agriculture, we moved to the French, so we weren't all against the French. So, but that relationship goes whenever they pull out. And, you know, let's see what Theresa May... We were talking earlier on about what Theresa May said in the Telegraph this morning, Harry, but, you know, she said a totally different thing last Sunday. So I wouldn't be... You know, last Sunday she said that... Or two Sundays ago she said that the withdrawal agreement was the only agreement that she spent 2 years on it. It couldn't change. She wouldn't do it. So she'd probably say something else again on Tuesday week.
I'm almost tempted to say Atni and Kirog, Kirog Ella. But...
She will switch ground very quick.
Okay, listen, we will leave it there for the moment. Andrew McDowell, thank you very, very much indeed for coming in,
thank
and we'll take a break.